afternoon, good evening, Power Hour Nation, wherever you may be, from sea to shining sea, from the shores to the shores beyond the shores, to this wonderful planet we call Earth. Welcome to the penal colony of Jones's Guiana, whose prisoners you are and from which there is no escape. The rule here is total silence. We make no pretense at rehabilitation here. We're not priests, we're processors. A meatpacker processes live animals into edible ones. We process dangerous ones into harmless ones. This will be accomplished by breaking you physically, spiritually, and here. Strange things happen to the head here. Put all hope out of your mind and wait for the vaccine so you don't drain your strength. Those are amended lines from the great old movie Papillon, which was one of my favorites. And when you're dealing with a cult, it's kind of like being indoctrinated into a prison or a similar type of incarceration, because you have to be broken. You have to have that last step that Yuri Bezmenov talked about in a communist takeover, the normalization. And many of you are facing that. You're being broken. You're being physically and spiritually and mentally tormented to break you down. You're forced to wear a mask, to go places. By some strange coincidence, I'd even forgotten about it, but a long, long time ago when I was a young peace officer, they were doing a course on cults, and they didn't have enough students. And the sergeant came along and going like, hey, will you want to help fill up the class? So to get out of work, I just said, yeah, sure. What a great way to spend a day or two. And I went in and took it and didn't even think much of it later because I didn't really understand the great vagaries of cult manipulation. But I'm glad I got some of the basics because I see a quick picture around me. Either I woke up in a North Korean prison last year or I woke up in Jonestown because a lot of these same tricks and features are being used. So what better way to explain this, to go back in our little time machine to 1978 and talk about one of the great shootings and mysteries in American history, in my opinion, and that was the death of Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk. It was eulogized in a film about Harvey Milk, and when I watched that film, then a lot of things that seem peculiar about assassinations were there. The way evidence was handled and mishandled, the way stories were invented to create personas and destroy personas, it just seemed to be one of the scripts. And I'm so glad, while I was doing some research on this, that I came across a great book and I just passed on the information to Catherine and said, we got to get this guy. This is amazing. This is right up our alley. We can go back and review what has happened and teach a lot of people who are way too young to even know, and maybe some who are getting too old and have forgotten about what happened in San Francisco in those days. So joining us today is Daniel J. Flynn, author of Cult City, Jim Jones, Harvey Milk, and 10 Days That Shook San Francisco, and may still be shaking a good part of the world today, where famous people practice archaic old philosophies that Jimmy Jones was a master of. Welcome, Daniel. It's great to have you here on Power Hour Nation. No mask is required. We won't hold you in quarantine for 14 hours. You can just give us the wit and wisdom of your work.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, indeed. Take us back in time for the uninitiated, about some of the players, what was going on in San Francisco at the time, so that we can set the stage for people to begin to understand what we're talking about.
Well, San Francisco in the 1970s was really the hangover after the high. And the high came, of course, in the 1960s, where you had, the human be-in at the Golden Gate Park. You had the Summer of Love. You had all sorts of fun stuff going around San Francisco in those heady days in the 60s. But, you know, as with any party, you're always going to have to pay a price. And that kind of came in the late 1960s, early 1970s, where you had not so much, make love, not war, but you had you know, the Altamont killing at the Rolling Stones concert. You had the Manson family starting in the Bay Area of San Francisco and then moving down to Southern California. You had the Black Panthers setting up shop in Oakland. The Weathermen, they went underground, a lot of them in San Francisco, and you had some bombings and things there. But you had some really radical people, and it became very difficult to figure, you know, to differentiate between the political crazies and the just plain crazies. So people like the Zodiac Killer or the Zebra Killings, where you had a group of black Muslims going around trying to kill white people. They actually shot future mayor of San Francisco, Art Agnos. You had the Symbionese Liberation Army, you know, kidnapping of Patty Hearst. It was a lot of just insanity in the air. The New World Liberation Front, which was a group that shot up Dianne Feinstein's vacation home. They put a bomb on the windowsill of her daughter's bedroom in her house in San Francisco. So if you were in politics in San Francisco at the time, chances are you're going to get ensnared in all this craziness. It became very difficult for people to differentiate between who were, you know, radicals and who were actually just crazy people. And I think that's where Jim Jones came into play, that it became very difficult, you know, in that kind of environment for people to figure out if Jim Jones was one of these nuts or if was he a mainstream player. And unfortunately, a lot of people took him to be a figure of respectability and became boosters of Jim Jones in San Francisco to disastrous results.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Because a lot of the politics there was like a micro scale of things that people are discussing today, that, you know, Jim Jones is working on filling buses and taking people from precinct to vote and help get people elected, that he has a strong-arm mob that can move through the streets and threaten and or intimidate people if he so wished, and that, you know, there's all kinds of political connections with people that are a little bit off the radar that are influencing politics.
Sure. I mean, that's kind of where he gets his power, that Jim Jones supplies, you know, if you want to have a political rally, he'll have a mob there in a second. If you need a letter writing campaign, he will mobilize all his people and they will all write, you know, 50 letters each, and a politician will get swamped with letters. You know, when Rosalind Carter came to San Francisco to campaign for her husband for president of the United States in 1976, the person she has introduce her is Jim Jones. I mean, that's how in with the in crowd Jim Jones was in San Francisco. So in the 1975 mayoral election, what happens is that Jones supplies, you know, over 1,000 volunteers for Moscone, George Moscone, who was the liberal candidate, and he ends up winning by a very slim margin. He also does, you know, beyond these sort of above board tactics, he buses in a lot of people from outside of the city to vote. And the thought was that these people were not proper electors in the city. And when Moscone became mayor, the pressure on him to have an investigation of his own election was so intense that he tasked the district attorney with doing this, and the district attorney had his deputy investigate it. Now, it happened to be the case that the person investigating this was also Jim Jones's deputy at the People's Temple. And lo and behold, they found no wrongdoing. So you had this kind of circular atmosphere where Jim Jones could commit crimes with impunity because the people were investigating the crimes, in this case, was his deputy. But in most cases were people that had ties to him and were dependent upon him for volunteers, for votes, and that kind of thing. And that's why he was able to get away with so much in San Francisco. Not just get away with things, but be rewarded. Moscone, I mean, when I was a child, one of the reasons when I heard this had happened, that there were hundreds of people that had killed themselves in the jungle of South America at the behest of this man, I thought, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard of. When I was an adult and I found out that Jim Jones was a power player in San Francisco, I thought, no, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard of. Because when we think of Jim Jones, you know, we think of people like Charles Manson or, the Night Stalker or any of these sort of serial killers that you'll see on these cable documentaries on Sunday nights. You don't think of a guy of power, but when Moscone becomes mayor, he quickly appoints Jim Jones to the board overseeing the housing commission in San Francisco, and Jones quickly becomes the chairman of the housing commission in San Francisco. So think about that for a second. A guy who killed, you know, 900 people in the jungles of, you know, his tenants, in essence, in South America, they put him in charge as the largest landlord, in effect, of San Francisco. It's pretty scary. You know, he's in charge of, I think, something like 35,000 housing units. And that, you know, the idea that they would grant power to this man, it shows you how off their moorings the politicians in San Francisco were in the 1970s.
Oh, indeed. You know, it's just absolutely chilling, really. But a lot of the what they called COINTELPRO operations were housed or run through California. It was a very, very popular place for the most a sundry of characters to accumulate. And when we were younger, we were very naive about the depth and breadth of this. But, you know, many of the names are just so familiar to us, even after all these years. And to even think for a minute that, you know, this character, it's almost like he's pulling the strings on these people and using them as his vassals as opposed to the other way around. And
I think so. And I think they were under the impression that they were using him. And certainly, I mean, if you take a figure like Harvey Milk, certainly he was getting some good things from Jim Jones. He had run for office three times and had lost three times. And back then it was sort of a novelty for a gay politician to run for office. And so a lot of people viewed him as a large candidate. But when he got hooked up with Jim Jones, things started to change for Harvey Milk. Jim Jones gave him a printing press. He gave him a podium to speak to a thousand people at his congregation. He put he promoted him in his newspaper, the People's Temple newspaper, which went out to a lot of people in San Francisco. And he provided him with hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. And this was something that helped Harvey Milk get elected to the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. Now, I'm sure Harvey Milk thought, wow, this guy's done a lot of great things for me. But what he did for Jim Jones was far more valuable to Jim Jones. He gave him credibility. So just to take one example, when Jim Jones kidnapped a six-year-old boy and brought him down to South America, and his real parents were trying to get the State Department and others to bring that boy back, Jim Jones wrote a letter to Jimmy Carter, a man he had met, you know, or when he campaigned for president the previous year, and said that Jim Jones was a man of the highest character, that the boys, he cast doubt on whether the boys' parents were real parents, and said that, you know, one was a bald-faced liar, the other was a blackmailer. And there were consequences to this. Jimmy Carter did not pursue this. In fact, the State Department really took Jim Jones aside in South America. And that boy was one of the 900 and some odd people who were killed in Guyana, in Jonestown. And so I think this is in a very direct way, Milk had blood on his hands here, but a lot of the politicians in San Francisco certainly had blood on their hands. A lot of the celebrities in that clique around the Bay Area had blood on their hands because they promoted this guy. They gave him cover before the poor drank the Kool-Aid in South America. The powerful did in San Francisco, and it had disastrous results.
Well, did you ever think for a minute that he was being run to, Jimmy Jones, I mean, as an intelligence operation, that they were doing using him for more official purposes, and maybe that's why he was, the celebrity, the persona, is he was on the team, just on a dark side of the team?
No, I don't think so, because, there's no evidence of that. I spent 10 years of my life looking into it. He was someone, if you look at what was going on with him, you know, he in South America, he was teaching the people there Russian because they wanted to defect en masse to the Soviet Union. That was one of the options other than killing themselves. They had a group of guards called the Red Guards. They would wear red clothing. They would, read communist books, and they'd have speeches piped in through the radio transmission of Angela Davis and Huey Newton. In other words, these are not people that would be palatable to the American establishment or the intelligence communities or anything like that. So, you know, if he were someone like that, you know, obviously he did a good job of hiding it. But for, you know, I looked into this for 10 years, and there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that.
Well, take us back. How was he extricated to Guyana? Like, he just did this on his own, or he's running from the law, or making a strategic relocation to get set up there after, you know, perhaps the heat is on?
So in the summer of 1977, there were a series of articles in the popular press in San Francisco showing that Jim Jones really was not all that people thought he was, that he was conducting fake faith healings where he would pull out, you know, chicken gizzards and napkins and things dipped in blood, where he would pretend to pull these from people and say, oh, I've pulled out a cancer of someone. He had staged boxing matches where he would pit very weak members of his congregation against very strong ones, and they would get really beat up, and this was for his own enjoyment and the entertainment. It was also for punishment and control. There were people that were being forced to sign over their deeds of their homes to Jim Jones. So there were all sorts of scandals that were coming out in the press. And Jones, you know, like a lot of narcissists, he was very thin-skinned. He couldn't himself take criticism, but he feared that the law was going to come after him, and that he was going to lose his, you know, what he had built his whole life, this congregation, the People's Temple. And so in the summer of 77, en masse, People's Temple, about 1,000 people go down to Jonestown. Now, they had this Jonestown for several years prior to that, and they obtained the land in, you know, about 4 years prior to that. And people that I interviewed that were in Jonestown prior to Jones getting there, they thought it was really idyllic. They loved it. They thought they were building a better community, almost like a place where urban kids in America could go, or you know, and experience something different, or seniors could have a retirement community. And at that point, you know, they were building something. But when you have 1,000 people come en masse, it overwhelmed them. And also Jim Jones in Jonestown, you know, sometimes for 6 hours a day, he is wailing over the, you know, the communication system, the speakers, and lecturing to everyone as they're working out in the fields in that hot equatorial sun. It got old very quickly for people. Several of the people I spoke to never ate meat in Jonestown. One of them said they had some fish heads one time. Another one said they had some chicken feet. That was the only meat they had. They were eating basically rice soup every day, and they were working long hours, and it was extremely hot. When they got down there, I mean, one of the interesting things about Jonestown is that initially there was this characterization of it in the press as this was like some type of right-wing fundamentalist sect, when that was the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, if you look at the New York Times said it was characterized them as fundamentalist Christianity. The Associated Press said that they were religious zealots at the time. You know, in reality, they were hardcore communists. They were atheists. They were very open about that within Jonestown. All of the Bibles that any of the members had were confiscated, and they didn't celebrate Christmas in Jonestown. In fact, I spoke to a couple of people that were in Jonestown, one guy who got shot, and another guy who witnessed, you know, some really, really extreme things. And they both told me that Jones, after confiscating the Bibles, they had no toilet paper, and he instructed them to use the pages of the Bibles as toilet paper. And some people, even people who were committed Christians, you know, they did that. And you can imagine what that would do to someone inside if they were a believer, and you have this guy saying, go use the Bible as toilet paper. So what happened in Jonestown was very different from the way it was characterized in that first draft of history written by the New York Times and the Associated Press and others, who gave this impression that these were, you know, like Jerry Falwell types or something. They weren't that. They were very different from that.
Yes, it's almost funny that, you know, the medias that we trust frequently run off madly with their prejudices first before they gather any facts and spin a deceitful web. And, you know, the quick one is, you know, to label your enemies as the demon or devil for any sundry action that happens anywhere in the world without even first looking to see what the matter is. And hopefully it wasn't because they're providing some sort of disinformation cover fire. But, you know, in a documentary I just watched on Jonestown to refresh my memory, you know, you just look at this as like a behavioral modification central, you know, the means of punishment and just abject control, dehumanization, and that the master controls all thoughts and opinions under extreme duress.
That's absolutely true. And just to illustrate that with a story, one of Jones's lieutenants, his top lieutenant for a while, was a guy named Tim Stone. And Tim Stone's son was murdered in Jonestown. He got out, you know, over a year before they went down there. And his in 1975, he surprised Jim Jones by coming to a planning commission meeting. This was a meeting of like the 100 top people. And Jim Jones, knowing that he was a sensible man, said, "Tim, whatever you see tonight, just know that I don't believe in suicide." And this is 1975, and Tim thought this was peculiar. And what happened at that meeting, and this is 3 years prior to the actual suicides, Jones gave everyone wine, which was something unusual in the temple. They usually were forbidden from drinking alcohol, so the people indulged. And after they drank the wine, he informed them that that wine contained poison, and you're all going to die within 45 minutes. And so some people started freaking out. Some people thought it was just a test, a loyalty test. You know, there were very different reactions, but ultimately Jim Jones said, I was joking, but there may come a time where we all have to do this, and I just wanted to make sure who was on my side and who wasn't. And so at that meeting, there was one woman who freaked out and started running around, and someone shot her. Now, they didn't really shoot her, but people, even people that I interviewed now, believed that she had been shot at the time. It was staged, and Jim Jones staged it. And the reason he staged it was to provide this lesson. Don't disobey me. If you disobey me, you're going to be shot or you're going to be shunned within our community. But if you just go along, everything's going to be okay. And obviously for the people that went along and drank the wine, everything was okay that night. And they kept having more wine tests. In Jonestown, they had something called White Nights, where there was this fake siege where you'd have people shooting off rifles, and Jones would say, "That's the Venezuelan Defense Forces coming in invading us, or that's the CIA."
Boost your immune system naturally this year with olive oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that olive oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
I don't know where to start. There's so many products you guys offer. I think one of the first things I ever ordered from you guys was your clay. The clay is miraculous. I could not do without that. And the charcoal, you know, you can get yourself in a bathtub to kind of help take the toxins out. So just those two alone, but I could go on to the Optivita silver lozenges. Of course, then the Oregaresp and the P73, the oil of oregano, and your Vitamir toothpaste. Again, I could go on and on and on.
Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Break the bond to Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. get Strauss Heart Drops.
You know what my mission was when I started this, and I was so excited. I still am excited after 21 years. I said, anybody who's got mouth must use whitener toothpaste and mouthwash if they want to stay healthy. I'm going to make sure that it is available to anywhere I can put the product.
You got a lot of zinc in these products.
Zinc inhibits plaque growth. Zinc is also known to have an antibacterial properties. Also, zinc works to eliminate bad breath by destroying volatile sulfur compounds. Such an incredible product. And
wow.
I'm so proud to say my wife did that and saved my life, saved my mouth. And she is the mother of all the people who are using a vitamin toothpaste and mouthwash in the world.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
The Power Hour has been in existence since the turn of the 21st century. It is more critical than ever for you to sign up for our free newsletter and our breaking news. Simply text the word Power Hour to 22828 on your mobile phone or sign up when you visit thepowerhour.com. Our website again is thepowerhour.com or text Power Hour to 22828. Together, our legacy will live on for centuries.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
Welcome back, Power Hour Nation. I'm your guest host from Canada, George Freund. Joining us in this hour, Daniel J. Flynn, author of Cult City, Jim Jones, Harvey Milk, and 10 Days That Shook San Francisco. And in the whole auspices of cults and cult programming and deprogramming, these are concepts and ideas that shake you to this very day because there's still operators out there who will use tactics and techniques like this. And understanding them is just as important as understanding signs for a medical distress or a fire or anything else, that you're walking on very unfirm ground when you're approaching a cult. And I just decided to let Daniel go on until the commercial because he was on a roll and a lot of good information was coming out. And Daniel, if you wish to continue, please do.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were doing these dry runs of suicide, and they were conditioning people to think that they that the CIA or that the Venezuelans or some other force was going to come in and kill their babies and kill them. And people who are hungry and overworked and, you know, sleeping just a few hours a night, you know, it becomes easier to control them. And that's what Jim Jones found, and he was a master at manipulation. And this plan of his, you know, started about 3 years earlier. You know, interestingly enough, I spoke to one of the, I guess you'd say one of the guards or higher ups within People's Temple, a guy who played on the basketball team. He told me that him and Jim Jones' son and some others on the basketball team, so younger, fit guys, were conspiring to kill Jim Jones. And they spoke to Jim Jones' wife about this because they all sensed that there was danger ahead. But they all sensed that Jim Jones, you know, he was further out there on drugs and was just not himself, particularly after the death of his mother. So they spoke to Jones's wife and said, listen, you know, we think we got to take care of this guy. And she said, well, can you do it after you come back from your basketball game in Georgetown, Guyana? And I said, well, what was the plan like? And they said, well, it was involved a shovel, a gun, and, you know, a pretense that they were going to bring him out to the jungle, shoot him in the back of the head, dig a hole, and that would be the end of it. Now, as it turned out, they went to play their basketball game, and when they returned to Jonestown, they did so only to identify the body. So that could have averted a lot of tragedy, but they were not able to, you know, partake in that assassination.
Wow. Wow. would the world be different? Because as I understand it from the documentary, he was even trying to recall the basketball team to come back to Jonestown. Do you think that was because, you know, he knew about the plot and wanted to get revenge, or he's just trying to shut down the visit from Congressman Ryan?
Well, I think what he was trying to do is to get them to go and kill themselves in the hotel in Georgetown. So there was a woman named Sharon Amos who was really a committed follower of Jim Jones, and I spoke to someone who witnessed part of this, where she slashed her children's throats, killed a couple of them, killed herself in the hotel or in the compound that they stayed at in Georgetown. And what the radio people at Jonestown, at Jones's behest, were trying to do was to get the basketball team and everyone else in Georgetown to kill themselves at simultaneously with the people in Jonestown. There was one woman who did that with her kids, but because of Jones's son was kind of strong-willed and knew his father was a crackpot, he kept that information from people, and they were far enough away where that idea was not all that appealing to people. That, you know, why are we being asked to kill ourselves? This is weird. So that saved things. In you would have had about 50 more people die in the capital of Guyana, but instead you just had a handful, and the rest of the bodies were in Jonestown, which was, you know, about 100 miles away in the jungle. And for people that wanted to escape, you know, and there were four African Americans, kind of two street smart African Americans and two elderly African Americans who, you know, one of them slept through the suicides. Another one kind of got up, saw what was happening and said, I better hide. I better go back to sleep. This isn't for me. And two other guys who were, you know, street smart young guys, and they escaped. But other than that, once the suicide started, the only people who lived to tell the tale, and I spoke to one of them, are people who Jim Jones let go. And those would include the two lawyers, Charles Gary and Mark Lane, and it would include three of his lieutenants, two brothers and another guy, who were allowed to leave, and they were given, you know, basically millions of dollars in cash and gold, and were told to take it to the Soviet embassy to give all their money to the Soviet Union. That money became too heavy. They dropped it, but they were let go. But it's amazing that you have 918 people, including the congressmen and the folks on the airstrip, including the people in Georgetown, killed, and only four people, once the killing starts, are able to escape. That's how efficient they were in murdering these people.
Wow. And as that's the Mark Lane that was the Kennedy researcher as well, who wrote the book on the Kennedy assassination. Is that correct?
It was, and he had, you know, unfortunately for him, you know, his reputation took a huge hit for this because he was carrying water for Jim Jones prior to this, as was Charles Gary. Charles Gary was a very famous lawyer at the time who represented the Black Panthers and, you know, was involved in all sorts of political high-profile cases. And in this case, I don't know that Charles Gary ever got over it because I think he really felt like he screwed up by taking this man on as a client.
Wow. But then when he did, he wasn't the psycho killer yet. That happened down the road, but strange bedfellows to be sure. When we go back to, you know, the lesser death toll, In the murders of Moscone and Harvey Milk, what are some of the vagaries in that story?
Well, the interesting thing with Harvey Milk was obviously tied in with Jim Jones, and Moscone was tied in as well. As I said earlier, Moscone made him the head of the housing commission in San Francisco. He was a big political ally of the mayor's, and he was a big political ally of Milk's. So initially, people thought, because it came about, you know, 9 days after what happened in Jonestown, they immediately thought that some of Jim Jones's assassins had come to San Francisco to kill these people. And there were rumors that he had assassins afoot. There were FBI cables and things that, you know, watch out for these people. They might try to kill others. And so that was the initial thought. But obviously people witnessed what happened, and they witnessed part of it. And a guy by the name of Dan White, who was a city supervisor, murdered both the mayor and Harvey Milk. Now, in history, what we're told is that Dan White was some type, you know, I've even read that he's some type of right-wing Republican who was homophobic, and that's why he killed Harvey Milk. That's nonsense. He was a Democrat. He was, you know, someone who often found himself voting alongside Harvey Milk, voting for, you know, affirmative action programs and voting to raise taxes and then voting to cut taxes later. And then, you know, he was all over the board politically. But there's this convenient story that people tell, to, I guess, to make Milk a martyr, that Milk was killed because he was gay. Now, the fact was, shortly before this, Dan White attended the largest gay rights fundraiser in the history of the United States. He donated to defeat a ballot initiative in California that was going to empower school boards to fire gay teachers. He sometimes voted for gay rights issue with Harvey Milk, sometimes voted against. His chief of staff, his business partner, the guy who was his campaign manager, was a gay man, and this was known to him. So this story that he was motivated by hatred of gays just falls apart at all of the evidence at every turn. Obviously, if you hate gays, you don't choose as the guy running your political life a gay man. So what really happened was that Dan White was a very troubled man, and he had resigned rather impulsively his position on the Board of Supervisors. When he tried to get it back, the mayor of San Francisco initially publicly said he can have a seat back. Harvey Milk went to the mayor and said, you know, are you crazy? We're losing all these 5-4 votes, and you want to put the guy who's putting us on the losing end, you know, put someone in there who's aligned with us. And that, you know, would, if a little bit Machiavellian, that's very sensible political advice. And so that's what the mayor did. And Dan White knew this is what happened. So it was just a matter of revenge from a guy that had a bit of a past that was quite violent. I spoke to one of his persons that ran against him when he won the supervisor's job, ran against Dan White. And she kept saying that you know, wherever her signs were, her political signs, people would be shooting out windows and, you know, causing vandalism. And in some cases, you know, these were gunshots. And so she was scared for her life in that district. And the thought was that either Dan White or some of his cronies, because he's a former police officer, had done this. And Dan White was also, you know, the police in San Francisco were also involved in a big strike in 1975 that became very violent. So this is a guy who had a history of this, and he was certainly fallen apart on the Board of Supervisors. And it's the motivation is simple revenge. Unfortunately, that doesn't make for a sexy story, and so people dress it up and act like he killed because he was a raging homophobe. And they can't really explain why, you know, why he would kill George Moscone, who was anything but homosexual. But that's the story that people have used for political effect. And it's very hard to kind of separate that from this fiction, separate the reality from the fiction.
Was he connected in any way to Jimmy Jones and the People's Temple?
Dan White was not. Harvey Milk and Moscone certainly were. There were people on the board to varying degrees that were connected with People's Temple. One who was kind of at a distance was, you know, now Senator Feinstein. The interesting thing about Dianne Feinstein was that she was the patron, she was the chief ally on the board of Dan White. She was sort of his mentor and kind of looked upon him as like an Eagle Scout figure. She really had a very contentious relationship with Harvey Milk. And the ironic thing about Dan White is that when he came into office, he did two significant things on the board. The first was when he came into office, he basically engineered kind of a coup where normally the chief vote getter would be the president of the Board of Supervisors. But he made it so that Feinstein was the president of the board through some shenanigans. And then obviously on his last day in City Hall by murdering the mayor, that's how Dianne Feinstein becomes the mayor of San Francisco. She was ready to retire at that point. She had lost a husband recently. She had been ill. She had obviously lost her races for the mayor of San Francisco, and she thought she was just about done politically. She had her beach house shot up and her, you know, bomb placed on her windowsill. So she was fed up with politics. But if it were not for Dan White, we would have never heard of the name Dianne Feinstein.
Wow. Did she have connections with the People's Temple, and to what degree?
To a much lesser degree than Milk or Moscone. In 1976, I believe, the Board of Supervisors awarded a certificate of honor to Jim Jones. And, you know, every week they would recognize various people in the community. And in some ways, these things were perfunctory, but they gave a certificate of honor and sang Jim Jones's praises, and she was certainly a part of that. But beyond that, it wasn't like, you know, you take a guy like Willie Brown, who was, you know, the former boyfriend of, or became the boyfriend of Kamala Harris, the current vice president. You know, he was a huge ally of Jim Jones. He, at a dinner, he compared Jim Jones to Einstein, Albert Einstein, and Martin Luther King. He wrote Fidel Castro a letter saying that he should give a state visit to Jim Jones when he went to Cuba in early 1977, and called Jim Jones a highly trusted brother in the struggle for liberation. So Willie Brown was a guy who was very tethered to Jim Jones. Jane Fonda, I mean, she wrote Jim Jones a note after she attended People's Temple services and said, you know, I recommit myself to your congregation as an active and full participant, not only for myself, but because I want my children to have the experience. You know, this is a little bit over a year before Jim Jones kills, you know, hundreds of children in Guyana. And here's Jane Fonda writing him a letter saying she wants her children to be a part of his church, and she's joining his church. Jim Jones certainly viewed Fonda as a member of People's Temple. But after the fact, all these people kind of scattered. And I just find it interesting. People ask Jane Fonda all sorts of questions about her plastic surgery and when she went to Vietnam and sat on that anti-aircraft gun. But they never ask her, hey, why did you join People's Temple? Why did you run interference with this guy? Why did you go out in the press and vouch for his character? She did something that's very shameful, and she's never had to really answer any questions for it.
Well, that's what I find, you know, very disturbing, just because that's what was the line that, you know, really set a fire under my interest in you and your book, is when I was reading a review that, you know, Willie Brown and Kamala Harris were lovers. Hopefully she wasn't a sex slave to a cult master, because she's, you know, walking into an administration. And, you know, I think if any of us even had a remote connection to, you know, someone like Jimmy Jones, like, we'd hardly qualify for a security clearance or anything like that. We'd be under great scrutiny to know the whys, the wherefores, and such. So that's something I find shocking, because cults can be very overt, but they can also be very covert, in that, you know, their initiates, just like spies, are infiltrated wherever they may wish them to go. And you may not find out what that is until they're activated. And being in a mind control game, that could be with a code word or gesture, and they're turned on from what has been programmed in their head. So that's why, you know, I'm very concerned about that. Also, in the fact that we're just looking at the world today, it looks like I woke up on the set of the old TV show The Prisoner or something like that, that we are doing very, very bizarre things that have never been done before. And your comment at the end of your Glenn Beck interview about, you know, you're in a cult when you can't visit members of your family. I had to do radio after that, and I couldn't stop thinking about that. Like, wow, I'm not taking the Kool-Aid, but, this is disturbing that family connections are being interfered with or broken in politics of fear for, you know, whatever the end game is. And there's just so many similarities to reality of the establishment of cults that make it, you know, like you're walking on a bed of nails. And that's why, you know, it's so important for people to understand this story and the history behind it, because there's just so much there. And as I recall from my reading, too, wasn't Nancy Pelosi's brother-in-law on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, too, back then?
Yeah, and certainly her political mentors, these two guys called the Burton brothers, and they all, one of their wives, they were really the mentors of Nancy Pelosi. They were heavy backers of Jim Jones. And Pelosi at the time was heavily involved in politics in Northern California, just kind of getting her start. But I didn't see anything directly linking her to Jones other than these people that were linked to her. But, you know, the amazing thing for me is that someone like Willie Brown, he was elected mayor of San Francisco after, you know, running interference for Jones for many years, he being such a political ally. In other words, you had other people. Art Agnos was a big political ally of Jones. He used to boast that he would refer destitute youth to Jim Jones. I wonder what happened to them. I know what happened to Art Agnos. He became mayor. And so there's something very vile about, if you look at San Francisco the past year, I mean, they've torn down statues of Ulysses S. Grant. They've torn down statues of St. Juniper Serra. They've torn down statues of Francis Scott Key. But yet they still have a bridge named after Willie Brown. They still have, a terminal, an airport terminal named after Harvey Milk, who was such an integral part of this, of boosting Jim Jones. They still have a street named after, I'm losing his name, but the fellow the newspaperman, the famous newspaperman, he won a Pulitzer in 1996, and his name is escaping me now. But in other words, they're still honoring people. Carlton B. Goodlett was maybe the biggest booster of Jim Jones there was, so much so that after the murders, he went and defended Jim Jones and attacked the people who were criticizing him. This is after the murders took place. He did this on television, and yet now City Hall in San Francisco, the most prominent address in the whole city, is one Carlton B. Goodlett place. This is a real upside-down morality in San Francisco where people were rewarded for their association with Jim Jones. They certainly weren't punished by it. And then, you know, you have them right now taking George Washington's name off of school. Kind of a topsy-turvy world that they live in. And certainly in the 70s, it was so discombobulated. They were so off their moorings. And that's why you had a guy like Jim Jones rising to such a place of prominence in the city that he did.
Well, when we look at the fact that they mentor communism, and one of the great pogroms going was Mao's Cultural Revolution, we see, too, that the heroes of the Cultural Revolution are espoused even still today, and those who would stand in their way or be alternative methods or means of thought, like great American heroes, are just cast aside into the dustbin of history, because that's all part of, you know, rebuilding this Cultural Revolution into, you know, the Soviet socialist states of dystopia. And that's another thing I find very disturbing about the whole state of affairs of the world today, as we seem to be moving in that general direction. Well, we're not free to pick and choose what we like, even though that's part and parcel of the American dialectic and also the fundamentals of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that the UN has, that you have a right to an opinion, and you have a right to freely move about, and that these things are being steamrollered is quite disturbing. And, you know, we just have to thank you for all the dogged research you've done to at least bring a light to this, and we would strongly recommend for people to, you know, to brush up on some San Francisco history and start to learn about these cults, to learn about the people who are involved in these cults and their associates, and find out where they are today and what they could possibly be doing, because ultimately it was a death cult. They also had a nuclear annihilation wish. And
it was a friend of a friend. Yeah, and the book's called Cult City. So if they want to read the book, they can just, you know, type in Cult City or buy it at the store or do whatever they want. Dan Flynn, Cult City is the book.
Oh, do, people, because that's the only thing that separates us from servitude and bondage is the ability to read and assess. And, you know, we are so fortunate to have a gifted person who has authored a great book here, and a good way to support him is to buy his book. But the other thing is, as a great person once said, emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds.
Bob Marley.
Indeed, indeed. I always loved that one. So I guess,
thank you so much for having me.
We're coming soon to the break. Is there anything else, or, you know, and that would be the end of this segment, but is there anything else that you'd like to add to people that's important?
No, just thank you for having me, and if they like what they hear, go out and buy Cult City.
Indeed, indeed. And you can always listen to the podcast again and make notes. So we thank you very much, Daniel. It was a pleasure and a treasure to have you aboard here. And, you know, it's hard to do history like that because people are offended by, you know, just the severity of the deaths and the futility and such like that. So it turns people off in a subject matter like that. But the only way to protect yourself is to have knowledge and to teach your children about things like that or other people about things like that so they don't step into a cult scenario. The easiest way to get them out is not to allow them to get themselves in the first place. And
exactly.
Then comes the hard part.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniel. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, people, there you go. Some of the most contentious issues. I was much younger then when this was going down, and as a younger person who wasn't inured to things that we understand today, it just seemed there's a lot of crazy people in California. And one of the big reasons there are, I would say personally, and there is a book written on it too, that, you know, this was more a CIA operation. I'm not that naive. And, someone's taken over the world somewhere, somehow. And it looks like they're doing it, like, right now. And that, for some strange reason, we all woke up in Jonestown of late. And people connected to it got the keys to the White House. Scary. I'll see you on the other side with James Hart. Thanks for coming to Power Hour Nation.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiatics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? Thepowermall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com today.